senior astronomer of the SETI Institute, speaking on science searches for ET. Seth?
Thank you, Steve.
And I do want to let everybody know that we are recording this. And
maybe won't help me, but...
Well, I think it'll be very useful to many others who can't be here.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve. Thank you all for coming up out at 9:30 in the morning on a holiday. I can't believe you did this. It says something about your personal lives. I think that they just wanted me to give you here a little... get the soporific part of this morning's activities out of the way quickly. I'm going to tell you a little bit about how we're looking for life in space, and by the way, we are looking for it in the galaxy, since that seems to be the leitmotif of this group. We're looking in our galaxy. I'll tell you why in a moment. I have to say I have a great deal of sympathy for galaxies in general, not because I ever dated any of them, but it is true that when I was a grad student for much of my career, I studied galaxies. We were measuring how fast they spun. That sounds kind of boring, but in fact, it turns out that they all spun too fast. That's something we found a long time ago. And the reason for that is something called dark matter. So that was interesting. But now I do SETI, and I want to tell you a little bit about it. Some of you may have heard some of this before, but nonetheless. Let me just begin by telling you that while many of you may think that there is life in space, how many of you think that, by the way? Right? And how many of you think, no, probably not? Well, there's almost no point in having this talk. We should just go out and have some coffee, right? Since you all are convinced that they're out there. Most scientists would agree with your optimism, not because we found any. We haven't found anything, right? Not even microbial life, dead or alive, to quote the last president. We don't know of any life out there, but we think it's out there largely because of the numbers. It's a numbers argument. Here is the galaxy, or at least that part of it you can see invisible light from Earth, which is, after all, you're only looking about 10% of the way to the center of the galaxy because of all that dust in the way, but never mind all that. What we know, and we know this really only because of research that's been conducted recently. There was a paper only about a month or two ago, in fact, by some Europeans in which they used an experiment to try and estimate of all those stars in our galaxy, and the number of stars in our galaxy is something you should know for your next cocktail party. It's on the order of 200 billion, maybe 300 billion, a billion here, a billion there, really doesn't matter, but on the order of a couple of hundred billion stars. And the question is, well, how many of them have planets? Now, when I was a kid, which was just after the invention of the compass, when I was a kid, you would go to the planetarium in New York, and they would tell you, the way the planets were formed was by a close collision, or a close encounter, really, not actually a collision, a close encounter between the sun and another star, which ripped gas out of the sun and made the planets. Now, if that theory were correct, it would mean this is the only planetary system in the galaxy, because those sorts of collisions are extremely rare. Extremely rare. In the whole history of the universe, there might have been one. This would have been it, okay, in our galaxy. Well, but that theory is wrong. And the results that were published 2 months ago said, well, probably 80 or 90% of all stars have planets. Okay, well, 80% is the same as all for an astronomer, of course. In astronomy, pi is equal to 1 and all that. So, and since planets are like kittens, you don't just get one usually, at least that's what we seem to observe. You get a couple. That means that the number of planets in the Milky Way is on the order of a trillion. That's a big number. But just having a trillion planets, as you know, most planets are fairly worthless. If I ask you, how does Neptune affect your gusto-grabbing, free-living lifestyle, most of you would say, not much. Right? In fact, if it were to disappear tomorrow, you probably would still go to work and so on. So, the question is, how many of these planets are not like Neptune, that are not worthless, that might be suitable for life? And that's the question being addressed by the Kepler Space Telescope, NASA's space-based instrument has been up there for more than 3 years now, and it's just beginning to find planets that might be cousins of the Earth. Excuse me. This is perhaps one of the most interesting science experiments being run today, right? I mean, there is the Large Hadron Collider in Europe, billions and billions of dollars, in this case, billions and billions of dollars, and looking for such esoterica as the Higgs boson. In fact, there's a story in today's papers in the New York Times about recent results suggesting they may have found the Higgs boson. But again, I suggest to you that that isn't going to affect your daily lifestyle too much, because we expect to find it. Finding life would be a little different. This thing isn't looking for life, but it is looking for planets that are cousins, like cousins of the sun. Now, the jury's still out on this. Kepler hasn't found a single cousin of the Earth. I said cousins of the sun. I meant cousins of the Earth. It hasn't found a single one so far. It has found some planets that might be habitable, but it hasn't found any that are sort of like the Earth, that might be, you know, lacquered with oceans and atmospheres, clearly like the Earth. That we haven't found. But on the other hand, sometime in the next year, maybe two, it seems a reasonable supposition that Kepler will find these things. That'll be a big story. Now, what fraction of stars will show those kinds of planets? We don't know. But even if it's as small as 0.1%, 1 in 1,000, or even 1 in 10,000, that still means there are somewhere between a few hundred million and a billion habitable worlds in our galaxy. Okay? That's a big number. And what that means is that... That's a big number. Let me just say what it means. What it means is, if this is the only world that's habitable, right? And none of you seem to believe that. Not mine. I wonder, it could be ET. That'd be job security for me. It means that if this is the only inhabited world, then you're a miracle, right? You're a miracle. And astronomers, after 500 years of being disabused about believing in miracles, now are very reluctant to believe in miracles. Okay, so the miracle, let me emphasize this, the miracle wouldn't be if ET is out there. The miracle would be if ET is not out there. Because in this, you know, these very large numbers, that would make us very, very special. Okay, here's another argument that you might occasionally hear made about why, in fact, there might be a lot of cosmic company. This is a photo I made in Australia a couple of years ago. In the northwest corner of Australia, where they have what are called the Pilbara Hills, nobody lives there except a lot of flies, a lot of mosquitoes, and a lot of cows. But it has the distinction of having the best preserved sedimentary rock in the world. Okay. So this is a very old rock. We know how old this rock is. It's 3.5 billion years old, and that's known to a few percent. But the point is, it's well-preserved. It hasn't been churned up by plate tectonics like all the other old rock on the Earth. And you see those sort of round things there in the middle of the photo that look like fossilized cauliflowers. Those are what are called stromatolites. So those are fossilized bacterial colonies. Life. Okay. So the point is, the Earth is only 4.5 billion years old. By 3.5 billion years ago, it was already carpeted with biology. So biology appeared very quickly. As soon as the Earth could support life, there was life. And that suggests, but doesn't prove, but it does suggest that life is very easy to get started. So that's another thing. All right, so how might we look for it? This is the way we would look for intelligent life anyhow, 100 years ago. This is Percival Lowell. I think you may recognize Percival Lowell. If there's anybody here from Massachusetts, you will have heard of Lowell, or at least his family. Lowell was born into this very wealthy family. He didn't have to worry about what he was going to do when he grew up, because, in fact, he didn't have to do anything. But he was interested in astronomy. So he went to Harvard and studied mathematics, which is what you did in those days if you were interested in astronomy. He is said to have been probably the brightest student that Harvard ever had. Of course, it was only Harvard, so may not mean too much. But in any case, so here's a photo of him. He didn't take a tenure track position at some third rate university hoping to get a job, because he didn't have to do that. He just built his own observatory, which he modestly named the Lowell Observatory here in Flagstaff, Arizona. And this is a photo from around 1900. And as you can see, back then, when life was somewhat more civilized, you would put on a suit to sit alone all night in a dark dome to look at Mars. His wife, who was considerably younger, didn't find this all that interesting. She stayed back in Boston. We don't have photos of what she was doing in the evenings, but whatever. Okay, so here's Lowell. Now, Lowell had picked up on some observations made by a couple of Italian astronomers, and in particular, a guy by the name of Giovanni Schiaparelli, who said there were canals on Mars, and Lowell could see them. And so that's how he was finding life. This is some of his handiwork here. You can see he had these white globes. If you go to Flagstaff, you'll see these white globes where he would draw the canals on. Right. That telescope had an aperture, by the way, of 8 inches. It wasn't a big telescope. Many amateurs today have far larger instruments. Okay. And he could see these things, hundreds of them. He named them, he cataloged them, he drew them. He wrote books about why they were there. You might wonder, what are the Martians doing? Why all these shovel-ready projects? Why are they trenching their planet? And the answer was, well, look, Mars is going bad. It's drying out, and consequently they had to dig these canals to bring the water to the places where they grew their crops. And he wrote this up. He was a good writer, in addition to being good at almost everything else. And so the public believed him. Now, there were astronomers not far from here on Mount Hamilton, right at the Lick Observatory, who had a bigger telescope, and they couldn't see these things. They couldn't see the canals. And Lowell said, you know what your problem is? Your problem is you're in the wrong place. You're in San Jose, where the atmosphere is not as stable as it is in Flagstaff, Arizona. This is a photo made from a spacecraft of the same region of Mars, by the way, and you can compare the two and see that Lowell did pretty well, given how small Mars looks through an 8-inch refractor. In terms of the big gray areas, you got those right, but the canals are missing. Lowell died in 1916, by the way, still believing in the canals. By then, he was almost the only one. This is from a contemporary astronomy textbook showing what Mars might look like on the surface, somewhat like Santa Monica, without the cheap marijuana shops. Okay, so there it is. And in fact, this is an illustration from, I think, 1908, showing the Martians at play at their own cocktail party. I particularly like this rendition because you can see, you know, the females wear bows and they have long eyelashes and whatever. All kind of anthropomorphic. Most aliens in fiction are anthropomorphic, in fact. I mean, if one of these guys moved in next door, you know, you'd probably talk about them for a while, and after 3 weeks, you'd invite them over for dinner, I think. They look that much like us. Anyhow, this is what Mars turned out to really look like. This is from the mid-1970s when the Viking landers landed. And this was somewhat of a disappointment because this isn't what many people among the public, in any case, many folks expected. They expected to find Martians, or at least some sort of Martian shrubbery or moss or something. Okay, and instead, this is what they saw. You've seen a lot of photos like this, much better ones, since. But at the time, this was a major blow. And when people wonder why it is that NASA does not design spacecraft that directly look for life on Mars, even today, the Mars Curiosity lander, which will be plopping down onto the ruddy surface of Mars in August, the answers can be traced back to these experiments in the mid-1970s, where they spent a lot of effort making very sophisticated landers to look for biology on Mars and didn't find it. Now, that's contested by at least one of the members of the Viking biology team, but the consensus is it's dead, Jim. In fact, Norm Horowitz down at JPL at the time realized that the public was unhappy with this and said, well, it could be that there's life on Mars that looks like rocks. What look like rocks in this photo are, in fact, rocks. Okay. One shouldn't give up on Mars. I've already alluded to that. This is a recent photo, an orbiter photo. You see the brown streaks around this crater wall, and those appear in the Martian summer. They get longer, and it looks like it's just water melting, ice melting underneath the surface, only maybe a few centimeters under the surface, and, you know, and darkening the sand above it. And maybe the way to find life on Mars is not to go to Flagstaff, Arizona and look through an 8-inch refractor, but in fact, just send some sort of spacecraft to land right where those dark streaks are, dig up that dirt, and look at it under a microscope, because that's where the Martian life may be. Okay, what about intelligent life? Well, there is the question of what intelligence is. I show this slide up here in the upper right all the time, because in SETI, what I do for a living, in SETI, our definition of intelligence is really simple. It's just an operational definition. If you can build a transmitter, you're intelligent. Okay, you can build a radio transmitter. And I always encourage audiences to ask the person sitting next to them, hey, can you build a transmitter? And you'll know how to deal with them for the rest of the morning. So there's a photo up there of a guy who's adding some RAM to his computer. So he's clearly intelligent, or will be in another 30,000 years when he builds a radio transmitter. But what we don't know, and this is very controversial, somewhat unlike the question of whether there's life out there, the question of whether there's intelligent life out there is controversial. Because if I give you a million worlds with life, how many of them will ever cook up intelligent life? And you might think, oh, well, that's inevitable. Look, it happened here, it'll happen. Maybe. But on the other hand, you can think of a lot of forks in the road which might have led to a different result. For example, 65 million years ago, the dinos get wiped out. If that hadn't happened, if the rock that we think did that had arrived 10 hours earlier, you wouldn't be sitting through this enervating presentation. right? There'd be dinosaurs in San Jose. You might think that the dinosaurs would have gotten smart, but that's very unclear. It's unclear. So, you know, the only way we can answer this question of whether intelligence is something that's somewhat inevitable is either to find it somewhere else or to understand why it happened here. Now, we haven't done the former. So people have worked on the latter. They have all these sorts of research projects trying to find out why we got smart. This is a plot by Laurie Marino, who's a biologist at Emory University in Atlanta. And she just plotted the IQs of dolphins and toothed whales for the last 50 or 60 million years. You may wonder how she knew the IQs of dolphins from 60 million years ago, but she found this cache of SAT tests or something. Anyhow, okay, so, you know, I don't want to belabor plots because I know they're uninteresting, but what's plotted here vertically is time. So on the left, at the bottom is 50 million years ago, at the top is today, and then the horizontal axis is intelligence. So on the left is stupid and on the right is smart. Okay, so you see 50 million years ago, the dolphins were pretty dumb, okay, but then they developed echolocation, they got a little bit smarter, and then as of today, some of them are smarter yet. 2 million years ago, the smartest thing on this planet was a white-flanked dolphin. But you notice that some of the dolphins got dumber again. I mean, you know, a brain is very expensive metabolically, and that's why most of your neighbors haven't bothered to invest too much in them. Okay, but in any case, this is a species that's not terribly closely related to you, and yet they were getting smarter too. So the conclusion is there is a niche, an environmental niche for being smarter, okay? There's also the signaling for fitness idea. This is Jeff Miller at the University of New Mexico. He says, look, the reason we got smarter was this. It's just a reproductive strategy, which a lot of animals use, where the males display and the females decide, right? I mean, you know that for hominids, this is true, that men are merely a genetic experiment being run by women. Which always makes me wonder, because then you look around at the men and you say, this is what they chose for. But you know. All right, and you see, you know, the canonical example here are the peacocks. You know, the males show these blue feathers, and the females say, that guy's blue feathers are pretty good, but this guy's blue feathers are better, and he's the one that gets taken home to mom. And you wonder what's in it for her to have all those blue feathers. They only attract predators. And the point is, it means his genome isn't messed up too much. The chicks will be healthy. All right, so the best strategy for hominids would for you guys to go to parties, take off your skulls, pass your brains around all the women, say, hey, you know, check it out. Because your brain reflects the degree to which your genome is correctly wired up. Now, that's considered a social blunder, but if the guy can, tell a good story or sing or something like that, then the women are listening with their ears and they say, well, you know, Ralph's pretty interesting, but Rodney over here is more interesting. Right? It has nothing to do with them wanting intelligent partners. They may delude themselves into thinking that. But what it is, it means, you know, the genetic component there is okay, so, you know, the kids will be healthy. So the women are ratcheting up the guy's intelligence. And somebody like this, it's fairly popular. Okay, well, I don't want to belabor this. This is very interesting, and Miller makes many comments about how you can tell that this is true, which would amuse you, but I'm not here to amuse you, and I know I haven't. But the point is that, in fact, this is a very natural mechanism. If this is how we got smart, you know, this would work in almost any Darwinian system. Okay, so that suggests intelligence might be common. How could we find them? One way we could find them is to just look for physical evidence. This is perfectly legitimate. We don't do very much of it. I mean, you know, this is one of the Apollo photos that NASA didn't even bother to release, figuring you wouldn't be interested. Okay, this is Photoshop, right? But what the heck? I mean, if you found something like this, you know, you would be convinced that there's something of interest there. We don't do much of this. We don't, in fact, look for artifacts, which you could. The universe is three times as old as the Earth. There could be some very big stuff out there. Okay, and we, you know, except by doing ordinary astronomy, we don't look for ring worlds, things like that. What we do is what Jodie Foster did in the movie Contact. And we try and listen for ET on the radio. And that idea goes back to 1960 when Frank Drake here used this antenna in West Virginia. It's a photo I made 6 months ago, so it's still there, to try and eavesdrop on signals from ET. Frank Drake, by the way, is still very active in SETI. He comes into the SETI Institute every day in Mountain View here. He still looks like that. That photo was made when he was 14 years old. But actually, Frank hasn't changed at all. I tell him that's good news and bad news. The good news is now he's 82 and he still looks like he was 14. The bad news is when he was 14, he looked like he was 82. But, okay, all right. So that's the idea, and it makes sense because you can do the calculations, the one-line calculation. It's easy to figure out how strong a signal you need to be able to detect it here on Earth, and it isn't anything that we couldn't do, even a mere 100 years after Marconi. So we've used antennas such as this one in Puerto Rico, 1,000 foot across, but the point is we've not looked at many star systems, fewer than 1,000 very carefully. That's beginning to change now. And on that basis, it's not surprising we haven't found anything. The amount of search space, and that's what this diagram kind of tells you, has been very, very small. And so far we haven't found DT. But that doesn't discourage me because, as I say, we've only scratched the surface. So when are we going to find them? Well, we have new instruments. This is the Allen Telescope Array, named after Paul Allen, co-founder of Microsoft. And this is about 350 years, that may be true too, 350 miles in any case, from where you're sitting to the north in the Cascade Mountains of Northern California. There are 42 of these antennas. They're about 20 feet in diameter. In fact, by accident, I'm in my own photo here, so you can see how big they are compared to a person. And they cover a very wide range of frequencies. We're using them now to study star systems that Kepler has identified as having planets. That's our major project with the Allen Telescope Array. But the point I want to make here is that if you look at the speed of SETI, this is some index of how fast we're searching the sky looking for signals since that first experiment of Frank Drake's in 1960. You see that by the white dots, it's getting faster. And those of the three of you who are still conscious may notice that this is a semi-log plot. In other words, it's getting faster exponentially. It's following what's called Moore's Law, an economic law here in the Silicon Valley that says that the amount of processing power you can purchase at Fry's per $1,000 doubles every 18 months. Well, SETI is doubling in speed every 18 months too. And so to me, that means that if this experiment is going to work, it's going to work relatively soon. Now, it may not work, right? But if we don't find something in the next couple of dozen years, then I think there's something wrong with either the basic assumptions or, well, I mean, it could mean that they're not out there. I would have a hard time, I must confess, accepting that. That's a possible explanation, of course, not contradicted by the data. But my take here, and this is something that you might want to take home, is that, indeed, if this enterprise makes any sense at all, it's going to work relatively soon. It's going to work in your lifetime, you know, unless you're on life support here in the audience. Okay. All right. Just as a final thought, and that is the idea of our concept of ET. That matters because Percival Lowell thought he could find ET with an 8-inch refractor in Flagstaff because he envisioned this nearby race of individuals busy establishing a vast hydraulic society on their planet. So, you know, what do we assume? Well, we usually assume they're carbon-based. There's carbon at the top of this particular column in the periodic table. Carbon is important to our biochemistry, not because it's so commonplace. There are plenty of things out in the dirt here that are more common than carbon, silicon and oxygen, for example. But you're not made out of silicon, even though silicon is the second thing down underneath carbon. Like carbon, it has those four covalent bonds, you know, likes to hook up with other atoms, make complex molecules, but it doesn't do it as well as carbon. The reason we're carbon-based is not really an accident. That's just chemistry. So we assume that about ET, a bunch of other things that seem reasonable on the basis of engineering considerations. In other words, we kind of assume they're somewhat like us. And maybe that makes sense because we don't know any better, but let me suggest to you that maybe it doesn't. And that's this time scale argument. We invented practical radio roughly 100 years ago, right? So there's Marconi in 1900, practical radio. Within a half century after that, we had computers. I mean, they took up an entire room, but we had them. And probably within another 50 years from now, we'll have invented strong AI. We'll have invented our successors, our intellectual successors in any case. All right, now you can doubt this, and it is true that if you go to the artificial intelligence labs, they'll tell you we're going to have thinking machines in 10 years, and they've been saying that for 30 years that I know about. Okay, so you might say, well, but they would tell you if you were, you know, indiscreet enough to point this out to them, what they would say is, look, don't confuse lack of success with lack of progress. There's been plenty of progress. And many of them figure that long before 2050, we'll have thinking machines. By 2020, your laptop will have the same compute power as a human brain. That's for sure. It doesn't mean it can think, but the hardware will be there. Okay. But in any case, maybe it takes the 2050, maybe it takes the 2100, maybe it takes the 2150. It doesn't matter. The point is that within a few centuries of inventing radio, so you can be heard, within a few centuries, you've invented your intellectual successors. This cartoon just gives you the whole idea again. On the left, I have the evolution of a horse, right? There you see a horse at the bottom, 60 million years ago, horse was the size of a collie dog. Today, at the top, you see that a horse is roughly the size of a horse. Now, that's 60 million years of Darwin. On the right-hand side, you have the evolution of personal computers. I had one in 1977. The one I have today is 10,000 times faster. That's in, 30, 40 years. In other words, once you've invented artificial intelligence, then you're on a different curve entirely. You're not stuck with Darwinian evolution anymore. You're really no smarter than the Romans were. But the machines are getting smart very quickly. So the point is, this timescale argument is, if there's intelligence out there and it's gotten onto this curve, it's way beyond us. It's just not smart little gray guys that want to vaporize the planet or mate with you, right? Although that might be an improvement in your social life. That's not what we're talking about, okay? So forget those guys. It's just to tell you that when you go to the movies and you see E.T., you expect guys like this. Probably not going to be the case. You're going to be talking to some sort of machinery. Okay, I'm just going to end it there because I was asked to at least leave a minute or two for questions, and I thank you for your attention. Yes?
So, what about the concurrency issue? I mean, life on the planet, 3.5 billion years, we've been making noise into the cosmos since the days of Calvin Beauty, approximately. So, working backwards, what's to say that we're actually going to catch that glimpse of time when they're making noise? It's been pointed out that the radio noise